very much, and thank you very much indeed again to Leslie Bolt and Christina Santos for inviting me back to Brock to give what is a longer version of a talk that I gave in October at the colloquium that was just mentioned by the dean. And I'm very happy to speak to you today about some of the aesthetics of silent music. And while some might think that there's only one possible silent music aesthetic, I'll be talking about how that's not quite the case and discussing what some of those particular silent aesthetics are, how they're not confined to just the musical discipline, but how they spread into other disciplines as well, in the spirit very much of this colloquium. There are several different figures that I'll be speaking about today, literary, musical, and philosophical, all of whom I identify as modernist, despite the fact that some of them worked significantly outside of the period typically identified as modernism. Those are, as you can tell from the title of my talk, William and Henry James and Elizabeth Bishop. But we'll also be hearing, as you see from my handout, a little bit about John Cage and Robert Schumann, mysteriously. And while the connections between these figures aren't necessarily apparent, I argue that they all share a similar philosophical sensibility that manifests itself in their particularly musical treatments of silence. My talk is not going to reveal to you a project that locates literally musical moments by comparing literary and musical forms, but rather one that identifies how literature thinks, much as music itself thinks. Sometimes my non-musical texts, you'll notice, won't even mention music explicitly, but I'll suggest that they behave musically nonetheless. My project is one that examines silence to the end of trying to conceptualize some of the epistemological categories attributed by modernist scholarship to something called modernist experience, categories like those of time, space, and subjectivity. As I'll explain, for example, both the silent music of 20th century avant-garde composer John Cage and the work of poet Elizabeth Bishop conceive of silence as active and rhythmic rather than as static, and understand silence as eloquent presence rather than as mere absence. And while each of these words that I'm using, activity, rhythm, and presence, are words taken up by any scholar of silence in an effort to show that silence is something rather than nothing, examining Cage and Bishop's work allows us access into what more precisely that something might be. Musical silence helps me to explore the 20th century speculative philosophy of William James as well. And this is particularly the case when it comes to his study of the processes of human perception, embodied by one of his most fundamental concepts, the famous stream of consciousness. William James' brother Henry James' fiction can also be read with the assistance of musical silence, as his work succeeds in altering human attention, much as the silence in the music of his era did, and still does. In both his novels and German romantic composer Robert Schumann's mysterious unplayed melodies, there are what I, alongside thinkers like Emmanuel Levinas, just to name one, call traces, disruptions of the attention of readers and listeners, which when attuned to, rather than ignored as silence or mere absence, succeed in modifying methods of attending to the world in profoundly influential ways. Because the connections between the James brothers, Bishop, and Schumann are in many ways so unexpected, I feel it's appropriate to begin with the one figure on my list that we probably all know best considering the topic of this colloquium, John Cage. So many of our impressions of the role of silence in music, of course, and Western art music in particular, come from him. His work encourages us to see that silence must be listened to for the very fact that pure silence does not exist as anything more than a theoretical possibility. Cage sought throughout his career to prove that wherever there are living bodies, there is sound, and that that sound is music. While he called the famous 4 minutes 33 seconds his silent piece, it certainly was anything but at the level of reality. We likely all know the oft-told story of the piece's premiere in Woodstock, New York in 1952, when the audience, sitting before pianist David Tudor's rendition of 4:33, became angry in the face of what they heard, or rather didn't hear. They talked, they shuffled in their seats, and they walked out in refusal of the piece's three musicless movements, creating an array of sound that filled the performance hall. For Cage, that very array proved the inaccessibility of silence. And of course, we know there was no real silence at the first performance of 4:33 or any other performance of the piece hence, even before the most polite audiences. But barring this fact, allow me to propose the seemingly simple question that proves much more complex upon contemplation. If there were such a real thing as real absolute silence, what would it be? Or more precisely, how would we conceive of it? Let's look at an excerpt from Cage's score of 433 for an answer, by determining how it tries to imagine silence. As you see in figure 1 on my handout, this version of Cage's score has no notes and there is no key signature. There are only empty bar lines, instructing musicians like David Tudor to remain inactive for the duration of the piece. I'd like to suggest that the problem of duration itself, though, can lead us to a conclusion that the score cannot possibly be considered blank, at least as we think of blankness. That's due in part to the fact that this rather mysterious handwritten notation exists between the last, beneath the last bar line, reading 16 seconds. Regardless of what exactly that notation is meant to indicate, I argue that it contributes not to a blankness, but to a rhythm of sorts. And this is because, for musicians reading the score of 433, this notation gives an order. It tells them to initiate a process of internal counting, and indicates how long they must wait before turning the page, before recognizing the next movement, or before acknowledging the conclusion of the piece. Silence in this score of 433 becomes rhythmic and moving in this sense. It is thanks to time that it imagines what silence might be if it were within reach. It's conceptualized as a period of lively waiting, and that waiting, forced by the score of the music, renders the silence it represents as decidedly something rather than nothing at all. But if we doubt that duration itself is enough to render silence something, perhaps we have only to look to a figure like Descartes, for whom the word duration is a rich suggestion of tangibility, even though he speaks of a theoretical world, right? The very fact that the reader of 433's score is ordered to track its duration indeed brings about a recognition of something that can't otherwise be located, and generates a presence, though it be the presence of an absence. If we define potentiality, as Aristotle does, as just such a presence of an absence, then we can begin to see how Cage's represented silence posits just such a potentiality. We can characterize what it attempts to imagine as the presence of an absence, to be sure, because of the very fact that it orders the musicians for whom it is intended to count. In waiting, silence embodies potentiality itself. The waiting posits silence as something that is always yet to be, but also always in the process of emergence. And while we, alongside many philosophers, might say that what is yet to be is nothing, we would surely say that emergence is something. Cage was not the only composer to create a so-called silent piece with time as its primary concern. As you see in figure 2, late 19th century French composer Alphonse Allais wrote a score that looks almost identical to that of Cage, with only a tempo marking to guide its readers. Again, duration, as it is manifested by the fulfilled wishes of simply that tempo marking, appears as the prime method of accounting for the world it attempts to project. But I want to speak not only of those scores that use blank bar lines in their efforts to represent silence, but also those that attempt to use more traditional musical notation, namely the rest symbol. The rest symbol is, of course, the most patent example of how music endeavors to understand silence through rhythm itself. It is an affirmation that silence is countable, and that it can be either quite simply or very complexly rhythmic. We see such complex rhythm in early 20th century Czech composer and pianist Erwin Schulhoff's 1919 In Futurum, as you see in figure 3. There's a wide variety of rests and a lot of visual input here, and we're reminded a little bit of Allais' Lento Rigolando tempo when we see Schulhoff's with feeling marking. The idea of silence, as Schulhoff expresses it in his score, has a feeling. It can be harnessed, and it can even be intricately apprehended with the help of time. Schulhoff's piece, though, allows me an excellent transition from a discussion of how silent music conceives of silence with time to one about how it uses space as well. And in order to think about this, let us imagine for a moment how it is that the musical staff is like a mathematical plane, both on the page at the level of representation and theoretically, in that it signifies an ordered sonic reality. Every note has its place on that plane as dictated by the rules of the Western chromatic scale. Even the rest, which is not a note on that scale, must be written into a particular position on the musical staff, as every composer knows, and thus behaves much as a note does as far as the score is concerned. Though the rest mandates silence instead of sound, it both represents a particular slice of time, as every note does, and assumes a particular spatial position on the represented plane. We see Shuloff's silence as a spatiotemporal presence in this sense, in that it appears much easier to track than it is in the work of Cage and LA. While their scores appear empty, Shuloff's looks quite the opposite. And while we have theories at our disposal, like those of Descartes, that claim duration alone can render phenomena like silence tangible, we may be more prepared to accept that idea when we look at silence as Shuloff imagines it. We're better able to apprehend it with a score that more evidently uses time and space to its advantage. Regardless, though, of whether we believe that empty scores render silence active, or whether it takes the musical rest itself to convince us of that fact by giving us a more apprehensible visual image of silence, the point I wish to make by showing all three scores is that musical silence is investigated at the turn of the 20th century, and as inherited and reproduced by Cage in the mid-20th, poses crucial questions about the interrelation of space and time in cognitive process. And the necessity of that interrelation of time and space to epistemology itself was contemplated by the field of philosophy in the modernist era. After all, for thinker Henri Bergson, working at the turn of the century, duration and space were hardly mutually exclusive. Due to the human tendency to measure time and to divide it up into spatial sections, much as the music read thus far does, time and space form a hybrid concept for Bergson. While many modernist critics insist upon describing modernism as an era that was obsessed primarily with space, the space of the cityscape, the space of the home and dwelling, the liminal, and even the virtual spaces, I want to suggest that it also, even though perhaps unwittingly, proved incapable of escaping time due to its overwhelming role in texts like the ones I examine. It is this idea that emerges with the help of musical silence, both literal and metaphorical, as we see in the work of one reader of Bergson, Elizabeth Bishop, who thought of modernist space, particularly the space of the liminal. While she often meditates on categories of time, space, and silence together in her poetry, I've chosen an excerpt from her 1933 prose piece, an essay titled Times Andromedas, which you see in your handout. In it, we read a description of a flock of birds as it flies over Bishop's home, rendered with vivid imagery that rather unconventionally sheds light upon musical silence itself. Bishop writes as you read, "They, the birds, spread across a wide swath of sky, each rather alone, and at first their wings seemed all to be beating perfectly together. But by watching one bird, then another, I saw that some flew a little slower than others, some were trying to get ahead, and some flew at an individual rubato. The interspaces moved in pulsation too, catching up and continuing the motion of wings and wakes, carrying it on, as the rest in music does, not a blankness, but a space musical as all the sound." There's so much to examine in this piece, and it has such a rich historical context, but it's clear that Bishop's late modernist conceptions of musical rest correspond to the similar thought present in all the silent music discussed thus far. Her likening of the spaces between the birds to the rests in music shows a spatialization of silence, for sure, silence as lively in-betweenness itself. And Bishop's use of another musical word, rubato, allows us to see what it is that renders that in-betweenness so active, what precisely it is that lies between the birds for her. Rubato translates from Italian as robbed, of course. To say that a piece of music proceeds in tempo rubato means that the musician following that tempo marking speeds up and slows down the tempo of the piece at his or her discretion. Essentially, some notes rob other notes of rhythms, and thus of time sounded. I suggest that Bishop's particular treatment of rubato allows us to understand that term in a different light, and to gain renewed insight into the role of the rest in music, and thus into silence itself. While we might traditionally think of tempo rubato, as I've just defined it, as a tempo in which notes steal sound, Bishop shows us how notes might actually vie for silence, much as her birds compete not for particular positions in the sky, but rather for in-betweennesses themselves. Just as these in-betweennesses, these rests, display agency in Bishop's work by carrying on the bird formations she likens to a piece of music, the silences within her idea of tempo rubato have more agency than the notes. Her rubato also forces us to imagine these silences using, again, both space and time. Because she imagines the birds beating their individual rhythms as they extend into the space of her sky, she suggests ways we might imagine rest's particular rhythms as they extend forward into a different space, the space of the staff. Her treatment of rests corresponds very closely to the way we actually have to imagine musical rest. If we try to create a visual image of rest, we likely always conjure something consisting of both time and space in this way. Like the silent musics I've mentioned, Bishop's description provides us with a visual image of musical silence that reminds us of the interconnectedness of space and time in our thought, and renders silence a habitable liminality. And liminality, a fundamental concept of space for modernism, becomes no longer just about space for Bishop, but becomes itself a space-time hybrid. The fact that Bishop drew inspiration for Time's Andromedas from William James is immediately obvious when considering his treatments of liminality and their connections to metaphors of birds and rests. He tells us famously that the stream of consciousness is, quote, like a bird's life, made up of an alternation of flights and perchings. And while he doesn't explicitly refer to music, as Bishop does, at least in this moment, because he does, his characterization of the resting places in a bird's flight path are quite similar to her characterization of musical rests. As Bishop suggests a focus on what lies between the birds, James tells us that it is the resting places in the stream of thought which we must consider substantive rather than merely transitive. James' concern with the liminal extends to language as well, as he calls upon us to consider the in-betweennesses of language themselves as substantive, its prepositions, its conjunctions, etc. He tells us that we should have a feeling of words like and, just as much as we have a feeling of words like cold. The philosophy that embodies this focus upon relations between things, rather than upon things themselves, is of course called radical empiricism, born from the school of American pragmatism, originated by both James and John Dewey. Radical empiricism as a practice proves important not only when investigating the musical silence of the rest, but also another less patent example of silence in music, which one may argue is not an example of silence at all. I'm referring here to an acoustic phenomenon whose tenets were hotly debated in the mid to late 19th century, and that phenomenon is the overtone, or the upper partial. We actually have the word overtone as a mistranslation, but overtone is the word I'll use here. As I'll explain, overtones are components of music that remain silent for those that fail to follow the sort of advice set forth by William James regarding the necessity of adjusted attention or the necessity of a reappraisal of what counts as substantive and what as transitive in experience. Simply put, an overtone is an audible pitch that is higher than and different from the fundamental pitch we hear. The fundamental pitch is the note being played, while the overtone is an effect of that note, which can be invoked in various ways by musicians. Invoking it through string harmonics is one such method, and certainly one that was popular during the modernist era. Orchestrators like Debussy, Stravinsky, and Ravel, among others, just use overtones in their work by writing scores that instructed their musicians to play string harmonics by dividing up the strings of their instruments in ways that made additional frequencies resonate. During the modernist era, music had no way of drawing the overtone onto the musical staff, as it does now. Instead, in the case of string harmonics, a musician ordered to produce overtones would see only instructions about where to depress a string, indicated by the small circle-like mark that you see in your handout. Because there was no method of visual representation, overtones remained indicated, but never accurately represented on the modernist score, a present absence on the page. Though overtones are not literally silent, and so they may seem less apt for a study of musical silence, they're often hard to detect, and thus they remain silent for many listeners. Overtones are sometimes referred to as ghost notes, notes that, because they are available to all, but successfully accessed by few, appear to haunt the notes that are being played. In the mid-19th century, the time, of course, that many of the world's acoustic mysteries were being investigated, there was a particularly lively rivalry between two German physicists, Hermann Helmholtz and August Seebeck, about the availability of overtones to the ear. Helmholtz believed, following the tenets of the famous Ohm's law, that they were always available if one could apply proper techniques of listening to them. Seebeck, on the other hand, claimed that he could not hear them in many cases and performed experiments in an effort to generate instances in which they eluded everyone to prove that every tone does not have multiple detectable frequencies, as Helmholtz argued. The details of each figure's claim are certainly complicated, and I'm less concerned in the moment with the scientific debate between Seebeck and Helmholtz, and more interested in the message that emerges in Helmholtz's fidelity to the overtone, despite scientific evidence that questioned its nature. Helmholtz argued that one's ability to hear overtones relies upon the intensity of his attunement, something, he argued, Seebeck did not have. And also, in a particularly William Jamesian radical empirical vein, attention to the relations between frequencies, exercise of the ability to effectively separate the tones by focusing the ear on the intervals between frequencies rather than upon the notes themselves. For example, in order to really truly understand the notes C and E, I would have to understand exactly what's between them. And when I understand that, I have an advanced sense of those two notes as phenomena. A relation for James, though, is not always imagined as simple in-betweenness. For him, everything we observe is a part of a vast array of relations, of which we are always peripherally aware. He calls this halo of relations around the things we encounter, appropriately, a psychic overtone. He uses the metaphor of the overtone to explain how consciousness takes in many parts of experience that it does not overtly notice, just as the ear takes in overtones without turning attention to them, and consequently without realizing their presences. Much as modernist musicians who wrote overtones into their music hoped to create something that demanded new and different methods of attunement, some modernist literature also sought to encourage altered readerly awareness by incorporating phenomena that are well described by the phrase psychic overtone. This is especially the case when it comes to what I call William James' brother Henry James' metaphorical silences, which I liken to such psychic overtones, in that certain messages in his texts remain absent or silent insofar as they go unnoticed by both characters and readers. William James' psychic overtone is a particularly apt metaphor for investigating Henry James' work due much to the overwhelming presence of, quote, voices in the air in his novels, which if you've read a Henry James novel, there are always voices in the air. These voices are not heard, but they're rather sensed by characters, and can be defined as intuitions of how others think, or of how particular life circumstances will unfold. Characters know that within the next year, they will meet the love of their life, etc. They're like telepathic communications, and they abound in many of his works, but particularly his 1886 novel, The Bostonians. Of course, many of the voices in the air in The Bostonians hardly seem supernatural when considering the subjects they convey. The character Basil Ransom, for instance, certainly doesn't require telepathic messages in order to recognize others' disapproval of his advances toward the young and innocent Verena. Nor does Verena's prudish mentor, Olive Chancellor, require telepathic communications to acquire knowledge of Ransom's liaison with Verena after having personally witnessed their amorous behavior. What I suggest, then, is that voices in the air in James' novels are less telepathic communications and more like memories. To explain, characters are not always fully aware of having formed impressions of others in James' novels. Therefore, when memories of impressions never fully recognized reemerge for them, they appear to whisper to them in voices in the air. Throughout The Bostonians, characters fail to notice what they have noticed. Original occurrences then carry, quote, psychic overtones, which later haunt characters much as I have argued that overtones seem to haunt fundamental mental pitches as mere illusions or ghost notes, as they are often called. The reader of the Jamesian novel must also reckon with psychic overtones. The experience of reading James is certainly one discussed in the realm of literary theory due to his particularly complex prose style. Even his early works, displaying less complexity than those produced after 1897 when he began dictating his texts, show a tendency to include so many details in his descriptions that the very point of their inclusion becomes obscured in the mind of the inattentive reader, and sometimes even the attentive reader. As a result of his style, the order in which he makes events happen in his texts, and sometimes even their sheer length, to which less enthusiastic readers of James will attest, there's a masking of the existence of interesting patterns in his text. Just as his characters sense knowledge without being cognizant of the origin of that knowledge, readers of James sometimes recognize his descriptions as familiar without knowing exactly why. This occurs because many of James' descriptions enter consciousness but remain only on its peripheries. These descriptions remain on the margins in this way because they seem unimportant when first encountered. It's also the case that descriptions resembling each other appear at significant distance from each other in the text. So when the reader comes upon a description that was originally perceived only peripherally and at a considerable narrative distance, only a sense of familiarity is produced. The sources of James' occluded patterns, though not quite locatable, leave, to take a word with great gravity for the field of critical theory, a trace that generates this feeling of déjà vu. Unlike Freud's famous memory trace, though, I suggest the original stimulus that leaves the Jamesian trace is not taken in unconsciously, and it is quite possible to recover through a careful process of rereading James' text. The trace for Levinas, much as I have argued it does for James, quote, signifies as a disturbance, but does little else apart from calling for and demanding attention. It is this demand, as posited by Levinas, which brings much to bear when considering my reading of Henry James' traces alongside the topic of silence. I suggest that each of James' renderings of the trace as a peculiarly haunting absent presence shares much with that of the overtone as it is defined by music theory. Using the overtone metaphor, much as William James does in his use of the phrase psychic overtone, in order to access a new look at the concept of trace, is a way of examining our concept of silence, of what it is, of how it too asks for our attention, and how we might hope to turn our listening toward it as we turn our attention toward disturbances in the literature of Henry James. A final example of a similar silent yet detectable disturbance that manifests itself in music comes to us through Robert Schumann and his 1839 piece titled Humoresque. Among other romantics, he composed a piece that featured notes he never intended to be played. And though he is considered quintessentially romantic in almost every way, I suggest that his dealings with silence show an anticipation of the efforts of figures like Cage, L.A., and Shuloff, and place him philosophically beside the James brothers and even Bishop. This connection emerges in one piece in particular, his Opus 20, titled Humoresque, in which we find a mysterious inner voice, or inner stemma, as you see in the middle bar in your figure 6. From Schumann's biography, we know that he included this inner voice for his wife to be Clara. It is meant in its silence to communicate affection for her, as we know from a letter she wrote to him 16 months before the completion of Humoresque. Because it is said to be taken from a romance written by Clara herself, and because Clara was an accomplished musician, familiar with her own work and with the techniques of counterpoint that assist in the hearing of the less obvious in music, she surely could have detected the presence of the unplayed melody's absence. However, I'm more interested in thinking about whether there is any way the uninitiated listener, anyone other than Clara, can discern the unplayed melody from what is played in the piece. According to musicologist Erica Reimann, this is very possible, and she tells us that the inner voice is, quote, implied in the textually complex meanderings of the right hand, end quote. So without getting too technical about how music, sounded music, can imply unsounded music, and it can, what is absent in Schumann's piece is implied by what is present. Silence is not wholly silent if what appears to be silent can be attuned to. Silence like that of Schumann encourages techniques of listening by providing hints that there is much more sensory input available just beyond the most prominent levels of awareness. However fleeting they may be, and however peripherally registered, the silences embodied by Schumann's inner voice, like overtones and like Jamesian traces, demand attention. Or really, our consciousness demands attention. Its functions demand attention. So in the last 2 minutes or so, I'm left with the question of what the implications of a study like this are. I've discussed musical silence as a window into how modernists and, in many ways, we contemporary readers of the world must use both time and space when we think of what silence is and when we think of it as a definite presence. And likewise, I have discussed the oft-studied realm of the liminal with the help of Elizabeth Bishop as one for which simple space isn't quite an adequate tool of understanding. I've told you about how William James' radical empiricism both addresses and expands conceptions of liminality by positing a relational view of the world. For all of the figures discussed, in-betweenness is no longer a simple concept of spaces or even of space-time, but of another realm altogether. The realm of the psychic overtone, of Henry James' voices in the air, of Schumann's hinted-at unplayed melodies, and of the trace, is one in which something happens too quickly to have happened. This is the realm of the virtual itself, if we follow the thought of Bergson, and the realm of potentiality to which I earlier assigned silence. As we know, silence is so elusive, for the very fact that if it does exist, it begins simultaneously as all pervasive sound ends, and ends simultaneously as that sound begins. There's not enough of an in-between for us to track it, even though we use in-betweenness and all its various characteristics to attempt to track it. Perhaps Spinoza describes silence best in his characterization of affect itself as, quote, neither activity nor passivity, but a third state, an excluded middle prior to both, end quote. And indeed, silence as a manifestation of affect would require a level of receptivity called by Spinoza, quote, pure and productive. Surely such receptivity would be the kind encouraged by music and by the literary and philosophical texts that possess their own musicalities, their own ways of showing that silence is a force which, if caught by consciousness for even a moment, can have wide-ranging implications. The contemplation of affect, as pondered by the figures I've discussed today, addresses the possibility of inhabiting areas of experience not typically considered accessible, even the immanent itself, a realm that remains to this day a concern of thinkers and affect theorists in particular, as it was for the modernists, who looked to develop a historical sense of their present by looking to the margins and by developing techniques of living beyond the normative. The project of all the figures I've discussed seeks to understand what's articulated best by the Henry Jamesian phrase that inspires the title of my talk, to understand what it is to have a, quote, adventure of not stirring. To attempt such an adventure is to rethink categories of experience that whisper to consciousness and that suggest a resituation of the self with regard to those whispers that never indicate absence in their barely perceptible natures, but rather the proximity of a fullness of experience, both sensual as well as intellectual. Thank you.